This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Civilization may begin to unravel just 30 years from now if we cannot mount emergency action to save a livable climate. From Australia, David Spratt explains the warning heard around the world. From the UK, lead author Eunice Lowe says thousands could die in New York or Los Angeles by 2050 from the heat. Then the next step in the local food revolution. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Climate-driven storms, droughts, and fires are coming much sooner than scientists predicted. Now an Australian report suggests civilization as we know it could break down starting as early as 2050. It comes from former fossil fuel lobbyist Ian Dunlop and Code Red author David Spratt, with an introduction by Admiral Chris Berry, once Australia's former top military officer. It's called Existential Climate-Related Security Risk, a Scenario Approach. It was published by Australia's Breakthrough National Centre for Climate Restoration, and it got incredible press coverage and viral social media buzz around the world. From Australia, David Spratt returns to Radio EcoShock. Welcome back, David.
Thank you very much for having me, Alex.
So, David, what do you mean by an existential risk to civilization?
An existential risk to a system is a threat or a risk that would either undo it or so damage it that it would take a very long time to recover. In terms of climate change and human civilization, it means that human civilization, the culture which we have developed, particularly over the last 2,000 or 3,000 years, would be severely battered and probably unrecognizable from where we are today. And this is not just our words. Professor John Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber from the Potsdam Institute last year said that we are now reaching what he called the end game in climate change. And recently he gave an interview where he said that if we continue down the present path, and I'll quote him so it's accurate, he said, there is a very big risk that we will just end our civilization. The human species will survive somehow, but we will destroy almost everything we have built up over the last 2,000 years. Now, that's a very eminent scientist and advisor to people like Pope Francis and the German Chancellor. So that's what we're talking about.
Just to be clear, you and Ian Dunlop are not predicting the world will end right at 2050, and as you say, that humans will go extinct then. So what are you saying?
Look, our report is in two parts. The first is an argument about how we think about the risks of climate change. And it's been my observation that a lot of the policy making is around the idea, look, there's a 50-50 chance, a 50% chance of something happening, which is really in the middle of the range of the possibilities. I mean, if you're an engineer and you've got a steel girder which you're putting into a building, and you could say, look, there's some risk that this might bend, okay. There's some risk that it might crack, not so good. Or there's a risk that the girder could actually snap and bring the building down. You would say that high-end risk of the girder snapping is the thing that you need to look at and avoid. So what we're saying with climate change, let's not focus so much on the middle-of-the-road outcomes, but look at the high-end outcomes and work out what we have to do to avoid them. My co-author, Ian Dunlop, spent many years in Royal Dutch Shell, and one of his areas of expertise was in risk management. And he says all the time, you have to ask the question, what is the worst thing that can happen and how can we avoid it? And so the first half of our paper is really making that point very clearly. Let's look at the high-end risks and how we avoid it. The second half of the paper is to say, well, what would a high-end risk be? And we know from the Paris Agreement and the commitments that were made there that at present the world is on a path to 3 degrees of warming because the commitments have not been strong enough. If you're adding some of the climate feedbacks, perhaps more than 4 degrees of warming. So we have simply said, if more action is not taken and we get to 3 degrees by 2050, in our scenario, it could be 2060 or 2070, what would the consequences be? And that's what the paper is about.
David, if I get a fever, we know medically about what point, what temperature that I would probably die, but do we know what level of warming civilization can withstand?
Well, this is a very difficult question because, you know, we have a certain degree of knowledge about the physical sciences. Then we have to translate them into the human impacts. We know some of the physical impacts. I mean, one of the papers that really influenced me was a paper published last year, which asked the question, if we get to 3, 4, 5 degrees of warming, how many days, particularly in the tropical zone, would people experience heat which is simply unlivable without air conditioning? And in some places, if you get to 4 or 5 degrees, the answer is more than 100 days a year. That is, those countries become unlivable. So we have a good understanding of those physiological impacts. But what are the impacts on human society? That depends on a whole lot of complex interactions. What are the impacts on the water supply? Where will the water move? Where will lands desertify? Where will be more rain? Will the productivity of crops decline? The fertility of crops decline with temperature? Yes. Do we have to add in this concern about a rapid drop-off in insect population? So this is a complex algorithm. I mean, we can say, for example, that the World Bank put out a report a few years ago, and they said that we may not be able to adapt to 4 degrees of warming. The World Bank is saying 4 degrees might be too much for us to survive, to be able to adapt. And if we don't adapt, we know what happens. Last year, one of America's leading climate scientists, Ramanathan, published a paper with co-authors where he said he thought that more than 3 degrees would, in his terms, be catastrophic. So I think in that 3 to 4 degrees range, we're really talking about impacts and consequences for human civilization and for many human societies where the conversation is almost difficult to have.
Why do you say climate is a security risk with backup from Australia's former Chief of the Defence Force?
Well, look, Alex, I think there are many ways to talk about climate change. Traditionally, a lot of the early advocacy and concern and work was done by what you and I would call green or environmental organisations. You know, you think of names like Greenpeace or the World Wildlife Fund and nature conservation groups. And that, I think, has led in some areas to people, particularly in business and government, seeing environment as a green or environmental issue. And it is my view, it is not a green or environment issue, and it should not be framed that way. This is an issue about the safety and protection of people and nature. I mean, we know that the first duty of a government is to protect the people, broadly speaking. I mean, whether it be their physical security, their safety, the laws we have about safety at home, on the workplace, in swimming pools, social safety nets for health and medical care and so on. I mean, it is the idea of the safety or lack of safety of people that I think is important. So coming from the national security, which is really about human security in the end, the security of people to have land and water and food and be able to live, is a different way of telling the story that engages different audiences. And I think for some governments and some parts of the bureaucracy, it's a fruitful conversation to have.
The mainstream prediction is up to 3 degrees warming by the year 2100, but you're suggesting that we might reach that 3-degree mark by 2050 instead. How does that happen?
Well, that is simply by taking the literature that is out there. There is a tendency in some of the projections of the IPCC, I think, to underestimate the future rate of warming. For example, they put out a report last year on 1.5 degrees, where they said, look, we think the future rate of warming will be 0.2 of a degree per decade, so we'll get to 1.5 about 2040. But there are half a dozen peer-reviewed papers that I can quote to you, which simply run the climate models, which show that for various reasons, the rate of warming will increase and will be at 1.5 in 2030, not 2040. I mean, this is materially important because this is the lower range of the Paris aspirations. And a paper by Zhu and Ramanathan just ran out the models on the assumption that we're not doing a lot more than we are now. I think we are decarbonising at 1% a year, which is about what we've been doing. And they said by 2050, we could get to around 2.5 degrees. And then they said, by the way, there are 3 feedbacks that we have not included in this modelling, which could add on more. So we've taken 3 degrees by 2050 as our scenario. In fact, their paper says there's, you know, a 5% chance of more of getting to 3.5 to 4 degrees by 2050, given the range of probabilities. So 3 degrees by 2050 is towards the high end of the range of impacts, but those are the impacts we need to look at. But it is by far from the top of the range. And whether we get there in 2050 or 2060 or 2070 probably doesn't matter for the purposes of the argument too much. It's the fact that 3 degrees is where the lack of political will is taking us at the moment.
If this terrible scenario becomes reality in 2050, you suggest the global food system will break down and perhaps up to 1 billion people will have to migrate to survive. That sounds pretty extreme. Is it really possible?
Well, look, it's not my words. For example, there's a UN report which we've just referenced in our paper, which looks at conflicts over land. And they said that in their estimation, in another 30 years, by which they meant 2050, 1 billion people in the world would either need to fight or flee because of the shortage of land on which to grow food. So here's the UN saying, just on land shortage, conflicts over land, 1 billion people might need to fight or flee. Then we have the other drivers of dislocation. For example, rising sea levels. We know, for example, in Bangladesh that a 1 metre sea level rise would inundate 20% of the land and displace 30 million people. I mean, one country. Then we have the other issues, such as the deadly heat, the lethal heat, where people will have to move because it's simply too hot to live and grow food there. So it is a complex interaction of different drivers: land shortage, desertification, changing monsoons, sea level rises, deadly heat. And I think that the 1 billion figure is not unreasonable. Look, we don't know. I mean, it might be 500 million people, it could be more, but it is certainly numbers that would be unimaginable now. I mean, we look at what's happened in Syria, where some drought and desertification in the east of Syria displaced 1 million people internally, and then there was the Arab Spring driven by rapidly rising grain prices as a consequence of climate events in Russia and China. And there was political domestic issues as well, of course. But together, those events have internally and externally displaced 11 million people in and around Syria out of the national population of 17 million. And some of those people migrated west into Europe with incredible political consequences for the European Union, for Brexit. And this is, you know, this is just a microcosm of the future. That's one small country. So you multiply that out and, you know, we have a terrible vision of what will happen unless we really treat this, as the United Nations Secretary General said recently, as the emergency that it is.
2050, I doubt we'll make it that long. Am I the only reporter who says that?
No. Look, I think there are a lot of people very concerned about the future. We have had an incredible response to this report. I didn't think we were saying that many things that were new because, in fact, back in 2017, some American national security analysts, including a former head of the CIA, put out a report called The Age of Consequences, which said the same things. In that report, they said that if you got to 3 degrees by 2050, in their terms, the world would be likely characterized by outright chaos. And they said the internal cohesions of nations would break down in the international system. The relations countries between countries would break down. I mean, this was Washington saying this 12 years ago, so this should not be a shock to people. Will it come early? Will it come later? Look, Alex, it really depends on whether we are prepared to say, as a national and global society, this is the biggest issue we face. This is an issue that's actually bigger than all others. If we don't solve this issue, all the other things we're concerned about might simply become irrelevant. That's the question that's before us now. I mean, I was really taken by an interview that the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres gave just a few days ago. And he said, look, he said, we need to sound the alarm. This is his words. This is an emergency. This is a climate crisis. And he went on to say that in politics, there's always a trend to keep the status quo. And then he said the following, which I'll quote you exactly. He said, the problem is that the status quo is a suicide, unquote. That's the UN Secretary General. So that's the conversation we're having now. So I think, you know, many people are now beyond alarm.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is David Spratt, author of the book Climate Code Red, The Case for Emergency Action, and many worthy reports since. And we're talking about a scenario where civilization starts to unravel as early as 2050. David, why do you think this breakthrough scenario went so big and so viral?
Look, Alex, I don't honestly know. I mean, we put out the report. We had an opinion piece in The Guardian here in Australia. It was picked up and an article ran on Vox. I think there were some over-the-top headlines. We didn't say the civilization would end in 2050. What we said is if we don't act, the high-end impacts of around 3 degrees will lead to these consequences, which have severe very severe impacts for the civilization as we know it and for displacement and social breakdown, which to me was all unremarkable because, as I said before, maybe we live in a more viral world. We know that within a few hours of that Vox report, I just tracked 12 stories on 12 different websites, and they had Facebook interactions that measured 600,000, and then it just spread into around the world, and there's been a lot of coverage in German and Scandinavian newspapers. So I think beneath this all, that there is a change in the conversation about climate change. I think people now realise that it's really a big, tough issue, more than they did before. After Paris, there was elation that this incremental deal would do some good, and it's obviously not. And if I can point to two or three things, I think the honest, brutal nature of the conversation that Greta Thunberg has started has been really important in the student strikes in calling out the adults. And she really calls it like it is. I think that's been important. If you look at groups like Extinction Rebellion in the UK, they've been calling it like it is. I mean, as you know, 12 years ago, we wrote a book called Climate Code Red, The Case for Emergency Action, which sort of established the idea that this was a climate emergency. And now you have groups around the world campaigning for climate emergency. You've had almost 600 local government councils declare, recognise climate emergency as the way to step it up the political chain. So I think there is a new realism about it. There are also some sort of doomerist, we're all doomed sort of people out there, what I call gurus of the apocalypse, whose analysis I think is wrong. But there is a more gritty conversation now, and maybe, you know, by the luck of the draw, our paper slotted into those circumstances.
News agencies asked a few climate scientists to fact-check what they called your doomsday scenario, and it seemed what they printed, most agreed you were projecting real possibilities. Have you had feedback from scientists?
Yes, look, I noticed that USA Today quoted a professor of applied physics at Columbia University, Adam Sobel, who said the scenarios, quote, don't seem that far-fetched to me. I don't think there's anything too crazy about them. A New Scientist quoted Mark Maslin from the University College, who said the University College London, who said it added to deep concerns, and he said maybe it's time for our politicians to be really worried. I noticed one or two people said that, you know, what we said was a bit over the top, but I think there is evidence for every statement we've made. I think some scientists are quite rightly a bit worried about the sort of doomerism, apocalypse-driven narratives we're getting from some people who just say, it's all too late, there's nothing you can do, throw up your hands, go bush, you know, put your money under the bed, buy a whole lot of tinned food, which is ridiculous and naive and childish. So I think scientists are reacting to that, but we've had very little criticism of the peer-reviewed science on which the scenario is based. Of course, the scenario is somewhat thinking into the future, but I think it's well-grounded. And look, the response. There have been some very thoughtful articles. One in Al Jazeera was extremely good, and and one in a German magazine called Climate Reporter, where they looked back at what Sheldon Hoover had said, What Lies Beneath report last year, a little film we did called The Home Front about the national security implications, and wrote a story saying, look, beyond some rather clickbait headlines about civilization coming to an end, there is a serious point being made in this report.
You know, science can only operate with data from the rearview mirror. I just interviewed the lead author of a paper about the heat deaths that will occur in 15 major American cities by 2050. But their model was based on numbers from 1987 to 2000. It doesn't include new developments like the increase of multi-continental heat waves or the appearance of back-to-back heat waves that I've covered recently on the show. So I'm worried now that science is dangerously conservative in its structure. Your thoughts?
I think we talked last year about our report on What Lies Beneath, which tried to look at some of those issues. I mean, science is conservative in several ways. First of all, you don't say something until you can prove it 10 times. It's not the balance of probabilities. It's evidence that really can't be disputed. So there are a lot of things that are going on you can't say. I mean, one of the really telling criticisms of the IPCC is that they're really obsessed by computer-driven models. And we know that those models can't deal with certain things. I mean, this first of all, the data and the evidence from the past on which you base the model. And because we are now in a climate system which now has more greenhouse gases than at any time since modern humans walked on this planet, we don't have the data analogs on which to do some of this. And then, of course, those models can't deal with what we call the nonlinear events. It's not the temperature going up and there being more water vapor in the atmosphere and winds perhaps being stronger and driving stronger cyclones because the sea surface temperature is higher. That's all well known and a fairly predictable response to increasing levels of warmth in the system. But it's the nonlinear systems where the ice sheets slip, where we start to mobilise the permafrost in the polar north, or where we lose something like the Amazon and a lot of carbon goes in the atmosphere. These nonlinear system step events are not well included in climate models because, in fact, you often don't know them, as you say, except in the rear vision mirror when you say, oh, look, it's already happened. That was the research about West Antarctica in 2014 where they said, we think that this system has already flipped and doesn't need any more energy to produce a multi-meter sea level rise. So, yes, it is, in that sense, it is structurally conservative, and that's why I think the expert opinions of scientists saying, I think, given my knowledge, the models, the climate history, my level of expertise, I think that X is going to happen. So, when somebody like John Hoover says, I think there's a big risk that civilization will come to an end and we will destroy almost everything we've built over the last 2,000 years, that's the sort of expert opinion which, to me, is as valuable as a whole lot of climate models which can't incorporate all the physical processes.
Right, and they don't take into account the fact that governments may not continue to function. I mean, history shows there can be government breakdowns or the grid can go down, and there's just so many factors that aren't allowable within the scientific model.
Yes, I was going to say, this is the big complex issue that, we have these capacities to produce science about the physical processes and perhaps, desertification and changing availability of water. But then you've got all those human issues as well that comes in. I mean, one of the issues that is happening in emergency management services in Australia, and I know in the United States as well, is what happens? Do we have the capacity if we've got two or three simultaneous crises at the same time? What happens if we've got a huge wildfire in California and a typhoon battering, a cyclone battering Florida and inundation somewhere else? Do we have the emergency service capacity, the human capacity to deal with three or four crises at once? And the answer at the moment is no. So, this is territory where a lot of concern is being developed. And that's why this discussion which we have about risk management really connects in with those sort of people.
David Spratt, is it possible the terrible scenario you and Ian Dunlop describe will not happen or will not happen for another century or two?
Well, that depends what we do. One can be pessimistic or optimistic about the capacity of the human species to not create the conditions for our own extinction. The record so far is not good. in that we have been decarbonising and reducing the carbon intensity of production very, very slowly. We now have to do this at an incredibly rapid rate. We know from study of past climate history that the last time we've had this level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, a little over 3 million years ago in the Pliocene, temperatures were 3 degrees warmer, which is our scenario, and over time, sea levels back then were at least 25 metres high. So we have already gone too far. Are we prepared to say this is an existential crisis? This is something that could bring everything we care about to an end? I don't know. I mean, I was really heartened where Will Steffen, who you and your readers might know as a professor of climate science from Australia and the lead author of the Hothouse Earth paper last year, which was the most downloaded peer-reviewed paper in history of the web, I think. And he last year said, look, in the Australian context, he said, we have to get emissions down fast. This means that it has to be the primary target of policy and economics. He said we need something like a wartime footing. Now, when he says it's got to be the primary target of policy and economics, I think that's the key issue. Our governments, our business leaders prepared to say stopping this terrible possible outcome has got to be the primary target of politics and economics. If we can get to that conversation, then I reckon we can get out of this.
Well, just to end on a terrible bright side note, if civilization collapses within one generation, would that solve the problem of climate change, leaving the world a better place for the rest of the species?
Oh, Alex, I don't know if that's a question I can answer. I mean, the problem we face at the moment, which was in the recent Stefan Hothouse Earth paper, is they said that, you know, there are circumstances where the feedbacks, where the system keeps on driving itself upwards, that if you can trigger enough of the permafrost, but even if we stop burning fossil fuels, the release of carbon from the permafrost, you know, will drive another 0.5 or 1 degree of warming. And there are other feedbacks like that. If we get to that point, we have triggered the system, so it will keep on going, even if we're not here, then the answer is no. That's the danger.
Is there anything else on your mind that you would like to talk about?
I would just say I've been doing some work with a lot of young climate activists, and there is a lot of deep concern about what's going on. I think some people are being too influenced by some of these gurus of the apocalypse, and we really have to have an understanding of the system and where it's going that is scientifically based. Gavin Smith, the head of NASA, and Kate Marlow both made the point that as it gets warmer, things get worse, but you do not get to a certain temperature where the world ends. I mean, it's not that 1.45 degrees is all okay and 1.55 degrees is terrible. I mean, there's not a moment where the lights go out. And I think some of the reporting, even some of the reporting on our policy paper, done by people who are not all that experienced in science and science reporting, tends to want to have that all or nothing moment. And that is a distraction and not helpful.
You can find the short and shocking new report from David Spratt and Ian Dunlop absolutely free at www.breakthroughonline.org.au. I will add further commentary and follow-up links in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Follow David's work, as I do, at his blog climatecodered.org. Thank you for telling us about your new work, David.
Thank you for the time, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. More people will die from heat as the world warms. It could be you or someone you know. A new study tries to tell us how many more people will die in 15 major American cities according to how hot we make it. The lead author is Dr. Eunice Lowe. She is a research associate in the Climate Dynamics Group at the University of Bristol in the UK. Eunice Lowe, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, why did you and your team of 12 authors decide to investigate heat deaths, and why choose the United States instead of the UK or some other place?
Yeah, so we have decided to estimate heat-related mortality in the future associated with global warming because you know, human lives and well-being is a lot more relatable to us. And instead of looking at how much warmer a place is going to be in the future, we are now able to look at how many people and how many people's lives could be affected by a certain temperature. And we think that will be a good indicator of future climate policy making. We've decided to look at the US because obviously there are many people living in the United States and there are major cities in the United States, which is the biggest economy in the world. Also, the United States is the one nation that has announced pulling out of the International Paris Agreement. So we want to assess the impact of actually limiting or achieving the goals in the Paris Agreement would have on people living in major US cities. And the other reason is that we do need reliable health and temperature data in the observations in a historical period. And we have a lot more reliable data in the United States than many other places in the world.
Well, that makes sense. And you emphasize the need to talk about heat mortality on a city-by-city basis. Please talk about the important differences in U.S. cities when it comes to dying from the heat.
Yeah, so we've decided to look at heat-related mortality on a city level because the relationship between daily temperatures and mortality risk is very different from city to city, even within the same country. And that's because these cities all have different climates. So people living in these cities are used to different ranges of temperatures. And so the mortality risk at a certain temperature will be different between the cities. And also the population structures are very different across the cities. For example, if a place has more elderly people who are aged 65 or above, these people are most vulnerable to heat than the other age groups. And so depending on the population structure or demography of a city, the mortality risk or the vulnerability of these cities will be very different. So it's important to look at the city level rather than a bigger region.
You know, some scientists and institutions say we are heading towards at least 3 degrees C of warming by the year 2100. Why didn't the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change work out that 3 degree scenario in their recent special report?
So I think the recent report on 1.5 degrees specifically looked at the impacts between, or the differences of impacts between the two targets within the Paris Agreement. So that's 1.5 and 2 degrees. And I think the goal of the Paris Agreement is to achieve these targets, right? So that's why we've looked at the differences, or other studies have looked at the differences in terms of impacts between these two targets. And the goal is to get there from where we are now.
You used a relatively simple model for the new study. What are some of the assumptions your team made?
Yeah, so we have made a few assumptions in our study, including assuming a constant population in all of our warming scenarios at the historical level. And that's because we want to isolate the impact of climate change in our study, rather than, you know, including other assumptions of population growth and so on. So the differences in the estimated heat-related deaths between the different worlds of warming of 1.5, 2 degrees and 3 degrees are only due to the differences in temperature in the future, but not other factors. We have also assumed no adaptation in the future, which is a strong assumption. But again, we wouldn't know how much adaptation there will be in the future. So it would also be an assumption if we would put relatively random adaptation scenario in it. So we've decided to keep all of these factors the same and to just isolate the impact of climate change on human mortality.
What is a 30-year return period for extreme heat, and why did your study use that?
So a 1 in 30-year heat event is an event that comes back every 30 years on average. So it is not an event that one might expect to happen every year or every other year, but every 30 years. So it is a relatively rare event, and we've chosen to study this return period because obviously we're interested in extreme events, and a 30-year return period is rarer and more extreme than an event that happens every year. And also we think this period is more relevant to climate policy making and also adaptation measures.
So I think some of the journalists who covered your paper might have gotten this wrong, because they said that the sort of peak of deaths that could happen would happen every year, and really you're saying they might happen every 30 years.
Yeah, some people got it wrong because it is a 1-in-30-year event. And so the number of deaths that we are talking about are the total number of heat-related deaths in a certain year. But that year doesn't happen every year. That year happens every 30 years. You know, I think some people are confused by the one, as in the annual number, being that it happens every year. But if we're talking about an annual number of heat-related deaths that is associated with an extreme event that happens every 30 years.
Well, that's what I thought. But I do have a problem with you choosing that for your paper, because it seems like we're getting record extreme heat almost every year, or at least very often, much faster than 30 years. We just had over 50 degrees in India. The American West Coast is in triple digits right now. So I wonder whether that's going to be really valid as a way of forecasting the future.
So you mean it seems like we're having a record, you know, extreme event every year?
Well, very often, much, much sooner than every 30 years.
Yes, I think you're right. And when we look at a 1-in-30-year event, so that's the definition of an extreme heat happening every 30 years, but the temperature associated with these events are different in different worlds. And I would think that, you know, for any adaptation measures or developing, you know, urban planning in the future, those are associated with longer time frames than every year. So that's the decision we've come onto, and to choose the 30-year return period. We have actually studied return periods from 1 year to up to 900 years, but we've just only chosen the 30-year return period as an example to highlight our results.
Right. But this is one of the problems with science when we look back at our climate, and you could go 900 years, but the climate is changing so rapidly that it's difficult to use the past analog to predict the future, in my opinion.
Well, I'm not sure how I can comment on that.
It's just a problem that I think science has to look at, climate science, now, because the climate is changing so rapidly. But let's move on. I mean, could you explain for our listeners some of the conclusions from your paper on substantial heat-related mortality in U.S. cities?
Our main result is that if we increase our climate ambition to achieve the 1.5 degrees target within the Paris Agreement, then hundreds to thousands of heat-related deaths could be avoided per city during an extreme event. And an extreme event is defined being an event that happens every 30 years. So it is essential, because currently we're on track to about 3 degrees warming on the global level. And this level of warming is implied by our current climate pledges within the Paris Agreement. So there's really urgent need for us to increase our climate pledges in the Paris Agreement to get to the 1.5 degree target in order to prevent large increases in heat-related deaths in the future.
Eunice, prior to this paper, you published two works about using sulfates in the atmosphere as geoengineering to cool the planet. Do you think that can work?
I think in the literature, there has been research about, you know, how feasible this technology is compared to many other technologies that have been proposed to cool the climate. So injecting sulfate aerosols into the upper atmosphere can potentially cool the global surface relatively quickly within a few years. But there are a lot of considerations that one has to take when considering using this technology. For example, if we start injecting sulfate aerosols into the atmosphere to cool the climate, we have to do it consistently and for a long time. Otherwise, the climate will return to the original state, non-cooled state, very rapidly when we stop doing the injections. And that rate of warming is a lot faster than the rate of global warming we're expecting now. So that high rate of global warming will affect our lives more than, you know, the current rate of warming or the rate that we're expecting in the future. I personally don't think we should inject sulfate aerosols to the atmosphere now because there are so many unknowns associated with this technology. We know some consequences of doing so. For example, it will deplete the ozone layer. It will change many of the things in the climate system. And it will also affect how plants grow, for example. And also, there's a huge concern of that when we stop doing this technology, when we stop using this technology, then the temperature will go up really fast, faster than the current rate of global warming. And it's also, there's a cost associated with it. There are lots of questions in terms of governance, in terms of who should decide whether we should inject aerosols to control the climate and who should decide to stop it. And also, the consequences are just going to be transboundary, affecting different parts of the world differently. So I'm against using this technology right now, but I do think research is needed to look at technologies like that in case we get to a point where we think it's better to take the risk of developing or deploying such technologies.
Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest from the Climate Dynamics Group at the University of Bristol, Eunice Lowe. We are talking about new science on heat deaths in American cities as the world warms. We think that somewhere between 40 and 70,000 people died in 2003 in Europe in the heat wave then, and an estimated 56,000 Russians died in the 2010 heat wave. Do such high numbers in a single year endanger the statistics produced by your model?
Well, I think the methods we've used in our paper are robust, and many studies in epidemiology have used this modeling technique to estimate the mortality risk associated with temperatures under global warming. And we've also used dedicated climate modeling scenarios to project temperatures in the future. I believe we've used state-of-the-art methods in terms of modeling in our paper. But obviously, we're looking at city-level mortality in our study, and we're also looking at differences between worlds that are 1.5 and 2 degrees in the future. And I think those will affect the numbers in our study compared to what have been observed in the real world in past extreme events.
The U.S. government, we know, is retracting climate controls, but city governments continue climate action. They are sort of leading the nation from below. Your new paper will give those mayors and councils more information to help keep voters on board with local climate action. Was that part of your goal as well?
Yes, it was. We basically know that temperatures are going to rise under global warming. That's the definition of global warming. And we also know that heat waves are going to be more frequent and more severe in many places in the world. But I think really estimating the numbers of deaths per city between different levels of warming that are the targets within the Paris Agreement or where we are currently headed will give a strong motivation to local governments and nations and also nations around the world to really increase their climate action to achieve the Paris Agreement goal.
Covering your new paper, both the New York Times and The Guardian in the UK gave headlines more to the coming heat deaths rather than the lives that could be saved with climate action. At least that was my impression. Are you more hopeful about the way your study can be used?
So I've chosen to estimate the deaths that could be avoided by limiting global warming rather than estimated the extra deaths that would happen if we, you know, let global warming continue to hit the 3-degree mark, because I think it is hopeful. Like we still have a chance to increase climate action to reach the 1.5-degree goal. But this window of opportunity is closing really fast. So I chose to put it this way of the benefits or the public health benefits of limiting global warming in order to give hope, you know, to policymakers and tell them actually you still have some time to act. And if you act now, then this will be the benefits to the public health.
There's a lot of good news science coming out about the way heat is changing as the world warms. In my June 5th Radio EcoShock show, I interviewed Dr. Jane Baldwin of Princeton about her paper, and their team found back-to-back heat waves are a new development since the year 2000. And I wonder, that may not be covered in your baseline climate, which I think ran from 1987 to 2000. So there may be new discoveries that, in fact, increase the number of future heat deaths, do you think?
Yeah, I think if we had a longer historical period of daily temperature and mortality that we kind of used, then the results will be, you know, maybe slightly different, because our results are based on health models that were developed with the data from 1987 to 2000. And if the periods that we included in our study included more extreme heat events, for example, then our models would have been more accurate in terms of estimating the mortality risk associated with very high temperatures, which currently we do not have, because temperatures that we are projecting in a 3-degree world in the future, for example, are beyond the historically observed maximum temperature during the 1987 to 2000 period. So a longer and more reliable observed data of health and also, you know, the climate would be very helpful in these kind of studies.
Well, there's always more work to be done along those lines. Another question about projected heat deaths is dependence on air conditioning in many American cities. AC is almost total in the South. But if the grid goes down due to the heat or any other reason, wouldn't heat deaths possibly multiply greatly?
So you mean if air conditioning goes down?
Right. I mean, I think your study presumes that air conditioning will remain in place as it is now.
Yes. So air conditioning is obviously one of the ways of reducing exposure to extreme heat at home or at work. So yeah, we have assumed that the accessibility of households and people in these United States cities to air conditioning to remain the same in the future. So if these changes or these increases or decreases in the future, then the number of heat-related deaths would change in the future. So this means that based on this study, if for some places in the United States where air conditioning is not that available, if the air conditioning is made a lot more available in the future as an adaptation measure, then these large increases in heat-related deaths could be avoided as well.
Yes. Like establishing cooling centers in cities have cut down heat deaths in some places. You can tell from the tone of my questions that I'm worried that the number of future heat deaths in this paper are extremely conservative. And I think you, in fact, do say that, because there's so many large factors in play and there are climate surprises already underway. Isn't it a bit dangerous when science underestimates the risk?
I think in some sense, our estimates are conservative. For example, we haven't considered a growing population or an aging population, both of which will increase vulnerability or, you know, at least the number of people exposed to extreme heat in the future. But we also haven't considered future adaptation measures, which will hopefully be in place after reading this study and also will reduce the number of heat-related mortality in the future. You know, it's hard to say whether these estimates are conservative or aggressive because we just haven't considered many things or many factors that will change in the future that will affect our results.
Well, I always think it's a good sign when a new paper stimulates a lot of questions. Eunice, what are you working on now and what are questions you would like to see answered?
So I'm currently looking at the urban heat island effect, which is when urban areas are a lot warmer than the surrounding suburban or rural area because of the different building materials in an urban area and also the limited sky view due to high-rise buildings in an urban area. So we haven't studied or particularly considered the urban heat island effect in our current study because the climate model we used didn't have that high a spatial resolution to represent structures or microclimates within a city. But with newer climate model projections, I'm hoping to look at how the urban heat island effect would change in the future and also how that would then affect human health and mortality within cities.
From the University of Bristol, we've been speaking with Dr. Eunice Lowe. You can find links to this new paper on heat deaths in American cities, according to Climate Action, in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much, Eunice, for sharing your valuable time with us.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
We just have time for a few-minute teaser for Deep Revolution. From Colorado, where they started the first transition town in America and led local food, here are Michael Brownlee and Lynette Marie Hanthorne. This is from a live online session called How to Live a Life of Destiny in a World Running Out of Time. It was recorded June 13th, 2019.
We've invited you here because we're very aware that the recent disturbing news about humanity's existential predicament is reaching more people than ever before.
Yes. Many are waking up to the realities of mass extinction, the devastation of our biosphere, and the possible imminent collapse of human civilization, even the potential for near-term extinction of the human species.
Increasingly, we're hearing that it's just too late to stop these disasters, that we've failed to respond in time to avoid worst-case scenarios, that now all we can do is learn to adapt to a profoundly uncertain and deteriorating future.
Our understanding of reality is being turned upside down, and it all seems to be happening very quickly.
Yeah. For many, this is deeply confusing, disturbing, even life-disrupting.
In this presentation, we will assume that you have been paying attention, that you are already aware of at least some of the dimensions of this predicament, and that you're not only deeply concerned, but also suspect that there has to be more to the story. Well, we're here to confirm that there is.
You may even feel that you're being mysteriously called to rise to the greatest occasion in human history, that perhaps you bear within you some great responsibility, a kind of deeper calling that compels you to not look away or turn away from what's unfolding in our world today.
Right. We've invited you here because you may be among those who are destined to be the pioneers of the deep revolution, an evolutionary course correction that is just beginning to take hold on our planet, just at the moment we are realizing that everything is at stake, that everything we all hold dear could be lost, everything and everybody we love.
So we've invited you here to consider the possibility of taking your place on the front lines of the deep revolution, for you are greatly needed now.
Before we go any further, we should say something about who we are and why we are doing this.
Together, we've been studying and learning how to respond to our collective predicament for many years now, mostly working with individuals who sense that they have a mission to fulfill or some kind of inner calling in the world, but often find themselves blocked, overwhelmed, or burned out.
In 2005, we expanded our work beyond the individual level to begin developing pathways for communities to become resilient and self-reliant in the face of the profound global changes that were coming, including global warming, fossil fuel depletion, and an impending global food crisis.
We were among the early pioneers of the relocalization movement, inspired by Post-Carbon Institute, discovering how communities could learn to meet their most essential needs locally again.
In 2008, we affiliated with the International Transition Towns Movement, which had begun 2 years earlier in the UK and was quickly spreading throughout Europe and other parts of the world. And we helped bring that growing movement to this country.
In fact, as Transition Colorado, we were the first officially recognized transition initiative in North America, and we began training potential transition leaders all over the country.
Michael served on the first board of directors of Transition US, along with Post Carbon Institute's Richard Heinberg.
This was all about making the transition from a fossil fuel dependent society to communities becoming islands of sanity and creative resilience.
With the transition movement, relocalization was going global.
In Boulder County, our home, we quickly shifted our efforts to focus on localizing the food supply, taking it back from the global industrial food system, which we quickly learned is responsible for producing more than half of all greenhouse gas emissions and is the largest and most destructive industry on the planet.
We also learned that of all deaths each year in North America, Europe, and Australia, more than half of those deaths are from food-related illnesses. In other words, the global industrial food system is killing us and is rapidly diminishing the planet's ability to support life.
And this still somehow escapes the notice of almost everyone, along with the dawning reality that an unholy alliance of big ag, big food, big pharma, big banking, and big government has not only stolen our food supply, but has also stolen our freedom and sovereignty.
With these realizations and knowing that global warming was rapidly diminishing global food production capacity, maybe 50% by mid-century, we came to see that the popular local food movement had to rise far above being merely a lifestyle movement, that it had to quickly rise to a radically new level of impact, effectiveness, and scale.
In 2016, I published a rather ambitious book about this called The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times.
Shortly thereafter, we launched the online Local Food Academy to begin to train people to lead the local food revolution by developing resilient and self-reliant regional food systems.
And this work is all continuing, and in fact, we're expanding it. For instance, on Earth Day of this year, Morgan James Publishing in New York released my new book, Taking Back Our Food Supply, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution to Reclaim a Healthy Future, which will soon self-publish as Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in a World Running Out of Time.
But we could see that the local food movement was failing.
What a way to end! Two founders of the local food movement say it failed. But Michael Brownlee and Lynette Marie Hanthorne of Local Food Catalysts are training new leaders, who they call the Emergency Response Team. Brownlee is the author of The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times, and Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. We're out of time. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.